Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Yield. Make sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube, and leave a review if you're enjoying the content. In case we haven't met before, I'm your host, Peter Kerr. I'm the Director of Product Marketing here at YieldTreat. Today, I'm joined by Willie Walker, who is the Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Wallop & Dunlop, one of the largest commercial real estate financing companies in the United States. Willie, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Peter. Nice to be here.
Yeah, we're excited to have you. To kick off, why don't you walk all of our listeners through a little bit about your background and then perhaps a little bit around what Walker & Dunlop does on a day-to-day basis.
Okay. Walker & Dunlop was a firm that was founded by my grandfather in 1937. My father ran it for his whole career. And when I joined the firm in 2003, it was a small mortgage banking company based in Bethesda, Maryland. We had one office, 46 employees. And my dad and I thought that the company was probably worth on a good day, $25 million. And over the last, since 2003 to 2021, we've grown that from one office and 46 employees to 40 offices and 1,300 employees. And the firm went public in 2010 at a market cap of $220 million. And today is trading at a market cap of close to $5 billion. So over the last 17 years, we've had sort of explosive growth on sort of any measure. And the one that's most sort of important to me is A, the number of clients whose needs we are meeting on a daily basis. B, having an incredible company with a great culture and great people and being ranked as a great place to work on the Great Places to Work Institute's list on an annual basis for 7 of the last 8 years. And then obviously the stock price performance to our investors. You know, look, our returns are, as a public company, going from $220 million to $5 billion over the last 10 years. I just did a chart of us versus the FANG stocks of Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and Google over the last 5 years. And the only stock you could have invested in and done better than Walker & Dunlop out of that cohort is Apple. And so we've had a great run. We've got a great team. And on a day-to-day basis, we go out and we finance commercial real estate across the country, predominantly apartment buildings. We are the largest provider of capital to the apartment industry in the United States in 2020. But we finance office buildings, retail centers, distribution centers, hotels. Then we also sell properties. And we have a very significant sales team that sells apartment buildings across the country that has been an incredibly strong market, particularly in 2021, when there was a huge amount of interest for people to both buy apartment buildings as well as sell apartment buildings. So that's what we do. And I'm super lucky to be the CEO and chairman of this company and work with the 1,300 people at Walker & Dunlop every day.
So, you know, to that point, you know, from the perspective of your role as CEO and chairman, you know, when you think about that explosive growth that the company has seen and you look forward to kind of the next 3 or 4 years, what are some of the key factors that you think will help drive the company's overall performance?
It's interesting to look at it, Peter, in the sense of the scale and the brand that we've been able to build. When I joined Walker & Dunlop, being a very small regional firm, I would go to a national conference and talk about Walker & Dunlop, and people would wonder whether we were a law firm or a finance firm or what we actually were. They didn't know the brand. And as we've grown and grown and grown and become one of the largest providers of capital in the commercial real estate industry, the brand has grown in lockstep. And as a result of that, that brand identification makes it so that more and more people who want to sell a property, buy a property, or finance a property are calling Walker & Dunlop. And so what's really neat to see now is now that we've built this scale and we go head to head with JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, CBRE, and JLL every single day, is that we compete with those big brands. And our brand is right up there in the commercial real estate space with those four huge iconic brands. And yet they're all companies of tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of employees. And we have 1,300 employees. And so as a result, I think we have a huge competitive advantage going forward as technology plays a bigger and bigger role in everything we do, where we can take technology and marry it up with the 1,300 people at Walker & Dunlop and continue to grow into new markets. Whereas all of our big scaled competitors, a JP Morgan or a CBRE, they've got tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of employees, whereas they introduce technology, adoption of the technology is going to likely do away with jobs rather than add jobs. And so that whole issue of technological innovation and implementation, I think being a relatively small firm with a big brand presents us with a great competitive advantage over the next couple of years and next decades, vis-a-vis the competitive set that we compete with every day.
So yeah, that's great to hear. And it's also, you know, really interesting is here, you think about these large banks with tremendous balance sheets kind of competing for certain businesses. And it's great to hear that also there are some other, you know, smaller companies that are kind of more focused and passionate perhaps in some regards around this industry. I'm curious, you know, when you mentioned some of the competitive advantages, you know, how does balance sheet play into it? And how are you guys able to kind of grow knowing that maybe some of the resources you had relative to those bigger banks were a little bit fewer?
If you think about our size, I mean, today we have a multi-billion dollar balance sheet, but when I joined the firm and I told you that it was a firm value of $25 million, we had no capital. We were a private company, no capital going up against the largest services and lending firms in the world. And one of the things that we were able to do was basically keep an asset light business model because we would originate loans and then sell those loans. And so the process of origination and sell has been great, except when markets disrupt. So when the great financial crisis came around, if you were in the loan securitization business, you were in a really bad spot. The thing that saved us and helped us was the fact that we sell a tremendous amount of our paper in the apartment space to Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and HUD. And so those government agencies that guarantee that paper stayed in the market and always play a countercyclical role when the markets dislocate. And so for us, the great financial crisis, while when it first came about, I was very concerned about what it meant for us and for the industry and for the country. We ended up doing very well throughout the great financial crisis because we could sell paper to Fannie Mae and then Freddie Mac and HUD, two licenses that we picked up in 2009. And then during the pandemic, similarly, as other sources of capital, banks, debt funds, life insurance companies that typically lend on commercial real estate exited the market, because we are such a big lender with Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and HUD, we actually had a very successful 2020 doing a lot of financing on apartment buildings across the country. And so it has been, the business model has been purposefully asset light, capital light, and then also having these large scale relationships with Fannie, Freddie, and HUD who provide countercyclical capital has been extremely helpful to us when the markets have dislocated.
Yeah, I think many people are probably familiar with, you know, agency mortgage-backed securities. But when you talk about, you know, the relationship and selling paper to the government entities, can you maybe walk everyone through kind of what that means and what the next steps are after they purchase the paper?
Sure. Trying not to get too technical here, but there is a very significant difference between the single family mortgage market and the commercial mortgage market. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac buy single family loans, as does HUD, from originators across the country. And the loan itself needs to be a conforming loan. So it needs to be of a certain size. It has to have a certain debt to equity ratio to it. And Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, or HUD will buy the loan. There's no qualification beyond the loan characteristics. In the commercial side, first of all, Fannie, Freddie, and HUD only buy loans on apartment buildings. They don't buy office loans. They don't buy retail center loans. They only buy paper on apartment buildings. But in the apartment space, to sell loans to Fannie and Freddie, you need to be a certified seller of those loans. And there are only about 25 companies in the United States banks and specialty finance companies like Walker & Dunlop, and then real estate services companies like CBRE that have licenses to sell those loans to Fannie and Freddie. So the first thing is that there are qualifications on the commercial side that don't exist on the single family side. The second thing about it that's very important is the whole reason we got into a crisis on the single family side is that if the loan conformed, it could be sold. And the person who sold the loan to Fannie or Freddie did not retain the risk on those loans. So as the single family mortgage market continued to get frothier and frothier, people were originating loans, selling them to Fannie and Freddie, and the risk sat with the US taxpayer. That is 180 degrees different in the commercial space. We, as the originator of the loan on the commercial space, retain the risk on the loan. So we, when we sell a loan to Fannie Mae, we retain the first 5% loss position on that loan. And so by having the risk sit with the originator of the loan, it makes the underwriting and the risk analysis far, far, far more focused and more real than in the single family side, where originators originate the loans, and as long as they conform to the box, they can sell them to Fannie and Freddie. On the single family side, mortgage insurance steps in to pick up the risk on the loans. On our side, we retain the risk with Fannie Mae. And on the Freddie Mac side, Freddie Mac goes and sells what is called the B-piece risk, or the first loss position, to institutional investors, so that Freddie Mac nor the U.S. taxpayer retains that first loss risk position.
So when the government does buy the paper from you, you guys retain some of it. Do they then reissue it out to the market? Is this, again, a securitization, or what then happens?
So on the Fannie Mae side, it's sold as single mortgage-backed securities. So there'll be a $22 million mortgage-backed security that has a wrapper or an insurance from Fannie Mae on it that investors go and buy. On the Freddie Mac side, they pool multiples of $22 million loans to securitization pools of about $1 billion. And then they'll sell off the first loss position in that pool to private capital. And then you will have A investors coming in and buying the investment grade securities.
Very cool. Very interesting. And also, yeah, so you're just describing there the difference between sort of a single asset CMBS and then also one that has multiple assets in it, right? As a different way, the different programs allow for different risks for the market. And the key here being, you know, not to put words in your mouth, being that, again, it just allows for more capital to help underwrite and originate new loans to provide more financing, right? You syndicate out the risk through the securitization.
That's correct. It's, you know, the whole reason that Fannie and Freddie came into existence was to try and allow banks to get the long-term liabilities sitting on their balance sheet off, replenish their capital, allow them to go lend again. And so that has been around since the Great Depression on the Fannie Mae side and since the Lyndon Johnson years on the Freddie Mac side. But it's that recycling of capital that has been so important to keeping mortgage rates in America low and allowing for home affordability and great liquidity in the mortgage markets.
That's great. You know, so kind of pivot here a little bit around, you know, what's kind of gone on in the real estate markets and also maybe what some of your expectations are going forward. You know, you mentioned a lot around increased transactional volume in 2021. So I'm curious, as you look back to 2021, what were kind of, you know, some of the additional notable things, and maybe you could spend a couple of moments also talking about why there was such a high transaction volume last year.
So there's a somewhat insatiable appetite for commercial real estate right now, and most specifically, multifamily or apartment buildings and industrial. The reason for that is that both through the great financial crisis as well as through the pandemic, industrial and multifamily performed exceptionally well. Why? Well, people have to live somewhere. So when the great financial crisis happened, even though people lost their jobs, they still needed to pay their rent and live somewhere. So multifamily did well, relatively speaking, through the great financial crisis. And on the industrial side, in both the great financial crisis, as e-commerce was really just starting to grow and explode, distribution centers and industrial held up quite well because it was an emerging business back then. And then during the pandemic, when everyone went home, all retail seemed to be arriving via Amazon and UPS. And as a result of that, the need for industrial space has again exploded and done very, very well. And so those two asset classes coming into 2021 had done so well in 20 that they appeared to have fantastic dynamics and risk profiles. And so institutional investors looked to put capital to them. The other issue is that because office, retail, and hospitality assets still had question marks about around them, any institutional investor who needed to put work to put money to work in the commercial real estate industry looked at multifamily and industrial. So you had this big kind of feeding frenzy on multifamily and industrial in 2021. as office, retail, and hospitality were healing. What you saw throughout the year, towards the end of the year, you saw that well-located hospitality assets were trading very strong, in some instances, lower cap rates than you saw before the pandemic. Retail, big box retail, completely out of favor, very, very difficult to sell a mall. Malls are being sold at massive discounts, but in line, infill, strip retail, extremely strong. And so if you have a well-located drive-in mall, if you will, that has a dry cleaner and a hair cutter and a supermarket, prices for those were extremely strong towards the end of the year. And then the big question mark is office, because nobody really knows the future of office right now. And so while a REIT like Boston Properties has been trading very well, the reason Boston Properties is trading well is what we're seeing is that users of office space like Walker & Dunlop are signing leases in Boston Properties buildings. They want A-class office space. They want all the amenities. They want it to be clean and new and pristine. It's the B's and the C's that are really struggling. And if you ask me today whether we would take an office space that was some, you know, great bargain, but it was a 1965 vintage office building, either in a CBD or in the suburbs, I'd say not a chance, because I don't think our employees will come back to a 1965 vintage office space, no matter how much we put in on tenant improvements inside of it. And so I think there's a big push for corporations to take brand new Class A office space. So that helps the Boston Properties. It really hurts the local owner of office space that built the building in 1965, hasn't really upgraded it, and is sitting there with, to some degree, a dying asset.
So how does that kind of conceptually play out? Both, I'm curious from your perspective as, you know, a CEO, and also, you know, your company's business as far as, you know, financing for real estate, but, you know, presumably moving, you know, companies into, you know, nicer Class A type office space would then presumably increase your rents relative to what you're kind of currently doing. So I'm kind of curious, you know, how companies view that, knowing that they're going to have increased costs around rents, versus kind of maybe having a more distributed workforce where, again, their operating costs in terms of real estate is probably a little bit less.
So a couple thoughts on that. First of all, because there is a glut of office space, Class A rents in some instances are up dramatically, but across the board, not that much. And so rent as a percentage of expenses is not up as it relates to most corporations in America. We signed a deal at One Vanderbilt, which is an incredible brand new office building in New York. We signed it in the depths of the pandemic, and our rent there is about half of what the going rate is today for new space in that office. But the interesting thing, Peter, is if you think about it, the tech firms are the ones who sort of said, you don't have to come back to the office, take, you know, as long as you want. Google said, we're never going to come back to the office unless you want to come back to the office. Meta has pushed back their return to office until March. And yet Meta just signed a lease at the end of December in Austin to take over, I think it's 36 floors. It's something like 600,000 square feet in an office building that's being built, the tallest office building in Austin right now. Google has taken massive space in Austin, as well as bought billions of dollars of real estate in Manhattan. And so it's very interesting to see the big tech firms who are outwardly saying, office, we'll see what the future looks like and whether our employees are going to come back. And at the same time, investing heavily in both office space to lease, as well as buying whole buildings in major MSAs like New York and Austin.
I'm curious, how do you kind of square that in your own head?
I think they realize that creativity and collaboration and culture all happen at the office, and that whether it's 2022 or 2025, people need to exchange ideas, work with one another, and create culture. And that's what creates great corporations. And as a result of that, while the back to office for everybody might be pushed back to March or a year from now or whenever, that at in the long run, office space is a very needed tool for corporations, and that we will get back to the office. And so I think they're thinking a little bit ahead. I think the other thing that they have a great benefit of is that they're just such fast growing companies that they know at some point they're going to use the space. I think that if you're ExxonMobil, who sold their campus in Dallas this past year, you know, if you're ExxonMobil, what are your space needs going forward? That's a, you know, I'm sure the CEO of ExxonMobil sits around and says, whatever our workforce is today, is it the same or is it 10% lower a decade from now? It's probably 10% lower a decade from now. So Google and Amazon, they're growing into this space. Exxon and other old companies who have to reinvent themselves somewhat over the coming decades, they're probably looking at space in a very different way.
That's great. Kind of thinking a little bit more around, I think a little bit of a comment that we discussed before the show started, but there is overall, you know, a lot of narrative around there being, at least in the United States, an overall home ownership or housing shortage. Certainly, we talked a lot about, you know, the necessity to live somewhere, whether renting or buying, but certainly there's a lot of narratives out there that there just aren't enough homes out there for sale. So I'm curious if you could speak to that and also maybe how that does influence the, you know, single family rental or multifamily rental space.
So there's an affordable housing crisis in America today, period. So you can talk about the opioid crisis and pandemic. You can talk about the fake news crisis in America. You can talk about a lot of different things that are sort of hobbling our society today. I would say that affordable housing is right up there on the list of the most sort of threatening thing to the kind of the fabric of our society. And the reason for it is that there is a significant undersupply of single family housing in America. Peter Linneman, who I have on the Walker webcast tomorrow, his number is that we are undersupplied by single family housing to the tune of about 2 million units. And when you think about that, we're only generating or building about a million single family homes a year. You have obsolescence and this $2 million home deficit, if you will, that's been out there for the last two decades, has made it so that the value of the existing housing stock is inflated up. And home builders are building new homes at a price point that is not affordable to most buyers of homes. And so what that's done is it's created a big chasm between people who are renting today, who in old times used to move from rental housing into for ownership housing and go buy a home and create real wealth in their home. That gap is now very wide. I just read a statistic that a year ago today, of all the housing inventory in the United States that was being built, 30% was going to come on market for a price of under $300,000. That's affordable. Today, that number is 13%. 13% of total stock right now is going to be priced at $300,000 or less. And so because the home builders are bringing in new stock at $400,000, $500,000, $600,000, that is not a starter home. That is not allowing the average American, that's not allowing a teacher or a fireman to go and move from rental housing into ownership. And so as a result of that, until there is significant supply of new single family housing, people will be, if you will, stuck in rental housing. And the issue there is because there's only right now somewhere between 300 and 400,000 units of multifamily being built in America right now, what you're gonna end up having is that there's limited supply of new multifamily and no supply of affordable single family, people have the ability to push rents. And so at a time when the value of single family homes is going up, interest rates are going up, that makes all of that far harder for people to get into. And then owners of apartment buildings have the ability to push rents because there isn't new supply that puts downward pressure on their rents. What it ends up doing is taking more and more of people's wallet share to pay for housing. And at the end of the day, in an inflationary economy, that's a real bite. And so I would just say to you that the single family world got over its skis back in the mid 2000s and started to build single family homes and got close to 2 million new units a year. And we clearly got over our skis and we saw a housing crisis that turned into a mortgage crisis in 2007 and 2008. Let's hope we don't get to that again. But at the same time, we need more supply and we need more supply of affordable single family housing to take care of this problem.
So how come the incentives aren't necessarily there for the home builders to make more affordable housing? And then kind of a second part to that is, you know, will this take a government intervention to create some incentives to actually, again, get this affordable housing?
Yeah. So the single family home builders did the exact same thing coming out of the great financial crisis. There was a great opportunity to build affordable housing. They all went for a higher price point because they could, and there was a market there, and they didn't supply the lower end of the market, if you will. They started to do that in 2016 to 2020, 2019. And then all of a sudden the pandemic hits and then we're coming out of the pandemic and everyone wants more space, bigger homes, and they're willing to pay for it. So all they're doing is chasing the market incentives. It's not like they're doing something to not supply one part of the market. They're just basically saying, if I've gone and gotten this land entitled and I'm going to spend time and effort building a home, I'm better off building a home at a $450,000 or $650,000 price point because I've got better margin there than going and building a home at a $250,000 or $300,000 price point. So to your question of, do we need government intervention? I would say the biggest issue right now is land entitlement. It used to take, I mean, depending on where you go, one of the reasons a lot of developers didn't go to Texas, apartment developers didn't go to Texas way back when, was because it was too easy to entitle land in Texas. Well, look at what the ease of entitlement has done for the Texas housing market. It's unbelievable, the amount of growth that you're seeing in Texas. So there's a lot of red tape. And right now across the country, when you really need affordable housing, one of the biggest things that municipalities need to get through is the entitlement process to build affordable apartment homes. Because if you're taking 2 to 3 years to go through the entitlement process, and then that supply takes 2 more years to build, we're 5 years out on any new supply. The quickest way to take care of the affordable housing crisis in America is for us to allow for manufactured housing, is the sort of technical term. Mobile home parks is the more sort of used term across the country. You could create a huge amount of affordable housing, except nobody wants a mobile home park in their backyard. And as a result of that, as long as there's regulation keeping people from building manufactured housing communities across the country, you won't get that supply. That's the quickest one you can do. That's better than single family. That's better than multifamily. That is the best. But local municipalities will not allow it to come in from a regulatory standpoint. And so you're not going to get a huge amount of supply there.
No, that's incredibly insightful. And you mentioned kind of Texas as being a potential model. You know, who else has kind of done it right, as far as, you know, again, trying to solve this crisis on a municipality level?
I think every governor in the country is trying to work on it. The problem with it, Peter, is that it is all at a local level. Mm. And so you can have Governor Polis here in Colorado talk about how he needs to do things, but guess what? He's not changing Arapahoe County and what Arapahoe County Board of Regents is doing. And so the problem is just that it's so localized, and in local jurisdictions, the local jurisdiction, you know, they're like, we'll go build it somewhere else. We don't want a mobile home park in Arapahoe County. We don't want it in, you know, up in Boulder County or Jefferson County, which is where Boulder is. So at the end of the day, unless local officials understand the importance and then governors put real pressure on them to make a change to the codes, it's not going to happen.
And then, so, you know, you also mentioned kind of inflation and the rate backdrop as kind of being, you know, again, a little bit detrimental towards home ownership. But, you know, thinking about that kind of going forward is also just kind of what some of the big themes are for 2022. You know, what are you all identifying as being, you know, the big drivers for real estate in 2022?
So rates moved in the first 2 weeks of the year, as much as most people thought they'd move all year. Okay, so we've gotten a year's worth of rate hikes, 2 weeks, week and a half. So there's a lot of people scratching their heads saying, does the 10-year, which is about, I don't know where it is this morning, but I'll swag it and say it's about 180, 182, which was at 145 at the end of the year, does it keep accelerating up to 2%? And does it blow through 2%? A lot of people out there saying that around 2%, there are going to be a lot of buyers coming into the market and that you will see the 10-year stabilize somewhere around 2%. I think and whether it overshoots the mark and goes to 225 or rallies a little bit and comes back to 180, right now, if I were betting and had to put a stake in the ground, I'd say it normalizes around 2%. We have to keep in mind that a 2% 10-year treasury is still ridiculously low. Throughout the 2000s, pre-Great Financial Crisis, which is where this lower interest rate environment began, we sat between a 4 and 5% 10-year treasury for pretty much that entire, well, 7.5 years prior to the Great Financial Crisis. And so people forget that that was sort of a normalized market as it relates to where the 10-year treasury should be. So when people sit there and scream and yell about a 2% 10-year treasury, it's still ridiculously low on a historical basis. Inflation, I still, even though I've got lots of people hammering me on this one, I still think many of these inflationary pressures are transitory. I think that once the ports start to flow, I think once chips start to arrive, that there's going to be actually not just a normalization, there's going to be a glut of capacity in a number of different sectors. I have a friend of mine, for instance, who happens to own a bike manufacturer, and I was talking to him about bike components. And all throughout 2020 and 21, you couldn't get a bike component. So bike manufacturers were going to the bike manufacturers, the component manufacturers in Asia, and saying, I need the cranks and I need the chains and all that stuff. And you couldn't get them. And right now, bike manufacturers are saying we're going to have a glut of capacity because all the manufacturers in Asia have cranked up production. And the peak of demand for new bicycles has basically passed. And so you're going to get a glut of supply in bike componentry at some point in 2022. And prices will come back down significantly. The real question, Peter, is on labor. And the interesting thing is that the labor force participation rate of 16 to 19 year olds skyrocketed during the pandemic, well above historic norms as it relates to the percentage of the workforce that was 16 to 19 years old. And the reason I raise the point about that specific demographic is A, they went to work because they could, because older workers were afraid of getting the coronavirus and they could go make some money. But that demographic churns very quickly. And so that 16 to 19 year old cohort that took lots of jobs, they're going to leave that job. And to rehire someone in that job, you have the opportunity to potentially pay them a lower wage. So if you or I went and we were 16 to 18 years old and we got a new job and we started at $15 an hour, and then because of labor shortages and everything that went on throughout 2021, we wanted to hold on to that person. They said, I can go across the street to Walmart and make $18 an hour. And we raised them up to $18 or $19 an hour. That person is going to churn. And so that company, that sandwich shop, that delivery service that has to go out to the market and hire someone new, they may have the ability to come in at a lower price point. And so while you can't take your salary, if you're at someone and say, hey, you were making $18 an hour last year, and now I'm going to bring you down to 17, a new employee, you may have the ability to start them at a lower price point. We shall see. But there's clearly wage inflation going on in the marketplace today. The thing about inflationary pressure is that one of the greatest hedges against inflationary pressure is buying real assets and buying commercial real estate. So as it relates to inflation in the economy, as it relates to why there's so much equity capital trying to buy office buildings and apartment buildings and retail, is because commercial real estate is a great inflation hedge. And the best inflation hedge in commercial real estate is hospitality. And the reason for that is because hotels reset their rates every single day. So hotels are always the first into a crisis, and they're also the first out of a crisis. And the reason for that is that they reset their rates every single day. The lease that we have on this office space that I'm sitting in Denver had a 7-year lease on it. We probably have another 4 years on the lease today. That doesn't change. Whereas in hospitality, you change your rents every day. And in multifamily, you change your rents every year. And so that's one of the things about hospitality and multifamily is that in you're in an inflationary economy, you have the ability to reset rates. Whereas in office and retail, you have, generally speaking, longer duration leases where you don't really get to reset them as inflation continues to drive up or the value of the dollar goes down.
Yeah. And so you know, when you think kind of applying that to 2022, you know, and I know you all don't necessarily make active investment decisions, but certainly as you lend, you kind of think about who the most creditworthy borrowers are. Do you tend to then lean towards, you know, continuing to like multifamily and, you know, hospitality, which certainly has gotten hit a little bit? What are kind of some of the commercial real estate sectors that you guys think might do well in 2022?
So there's a somewhat of a different view, Peter, from a lender's perspective versus an investor or equity investor's perspective. From a lender's perspective, we want to do as much volume as we can, and we want to do really sound loans. So that has us focused on multi and industrial because they're the most secure commercial real estate asset classes from a credit standpoint. And we want to do a lot of volume because we'll get perfectly fine spreads on it and make plenty of money, but we're not looking for that outsized return, if you will. If you wanted to be making, from a lending standpoint, outsized returns, you'd go make a loan on an office building. Because the cost of debt in the office space right now, particularly a B or C building, is much, much higher than it is to borrow on an apartment building. And so you can make outsized returns from a debt investor on lending on an office building. We're doing some, but not a lot. As it relates to equity investments, I would put forth to you that if you see the amount of liquidity right now in the marketplace, it tells you that cap rates are going to continue to go down across the board in commercial real estate. And so clearly you can buy a bad asset, but given in a inflationary environment with the yield starved world that we live in, one of the things you've got to keep in mind here is that today, this is an incredible statistic. Today there is $15 trillion more US government debt outstanding than there was in 2010, $15 trillion. And yet the interest expense that the federal government pays on that $15 trillion plus the original balance back in 2010 is less than they were paying on the amount outstanding in 2010. So people aren't getting current income from buying treasuries. People aren't getting current income from buying corporate bonds. And lots of companies cut their dividends during the great pandemic. As a result of that, we are living in a yield-starved world where one of the places where people can find yield is investing in commercial real estate. And so that's why there's so much equity capital trying to chase returns in commercial real estate. And it's one of the reasons why cap rates in commercial real estate will continue to go down.
So just for our listeners' knowledge, you know, cap rate, capitalization rate, maybe you could just quickly walk through what that means. And, you know, again, it's a little bit, it's a valuation metric, a little bit different than some others. Maybe you can kind of just explain what direction is kind of generally positive for everyone.
Essentially, it's the return you're expecting on that asset on a cash on cash basis by investing and what the cash flow off of that asset will give you on an annualized basis. So if you buy something at a 3.2 cap rate, you're essentially expecting a 3.2% return on it. Now, that's unlevered, okay? So you can put leverage on it and lower your cost of capital, and that then boosts your return. It also, generally speaking, is based off of a pro forma that sits with what you think are market reasonable rent increases. That could change. You could have an office building that today is only 70% leased, and you can go sign really good leases on the 30% that you don't have leased above what you pro forma'd, and now all of a sudden your return on that investment is going to go up. And then the other piece to it all is, where are cap rates? Where are the returns that people will buy the asset from you when you want to exit the property in 7 or 10 years? And one of the big things that lots of investors today are fearful of is that they go and buy at a 3.2 cap rate, and 10 years from now, when they want to go sell it, the market is only paying a 5% cap rate. So they need a 5% return on those cash flows. That's not a good day. But if you take a look at the amount of liquidity in the market today and some of the dynamics that I just talked about, Peter, as it relates to investors' demand for yield and what commercial real estate does, there are a lot of people who believe that cap rates continue to compress from here. The final thing I'd say that is really important to keep in mind is foreign capital. There is a huge amount of foreign capital that is looking for yield that they cannot find in their own sovereign debt. So if you go to Europe, all sovereign rates that are anything close to the United States are at significant discounts in return to the United States 10-year treasury return. And so as a result of that, there's a huge amount of capital that is both buying US treasury bonds as well as buying US commercial real estate. And so this yield-starved world that we live in is putting a lot of valuation inflation into hard assets in the United States.
That's honestly great insight. So Willie, you know, we're getting close to time here. I want to turn it over to you just to see, you know, how some of our listeners can, you know, you mentioned you also have a webcast as well, how some of our listeners can both learn more about your company and also just kind of hear you speak more often.
We do, Peter, have something called the Walker Webcast. It's every Wednesday at 12:30. Been doing it since the beginning of the pandemic. We've had over 3 million listeners to the Walker Webcast since we launched it back in February of 2020. And I try and have guests on who do everything from what Peter Linneman will do tomorrow to talk about specifically the macroeconomy and the commercial real estate markets. Last week, I had Dr. Michael Roizen from the Cleveland Clinic, who is the chief wellness officer at Cleveland Clinic, talking about health and wellness. And then next week, I've got Jim Courier, the tennis player, former number one tennis player in the world, who's down at the Australian Open, to talk about Jim's career in pro tennis and winning two-time Australian Open and two-time French Open winner, what it took him to compete at that level. And then talk a little bit about Novak Djokovic and arriving in Australia and being held up by the immigration authorities. And so that's kind of the breadth, if you will, of the Walker Webcast. It has almost nothing to do with, if you will, Walker and Dunlop. Although obviously when we talk about commercial real estate, like we will tomorrow with Peter Linneman, there are lots of clients of Walker and Dunlop who listen in, but we don't talk about what we're doing or what we're seeing generally speaking. I just want to get perspectives from my guests as it relates to all sorts of different things going on in the world. And it's been super fun for me, Peter, just like you. You have the obligation to do some background work on your guests and really understand what they're up to. So for me to learn all about what Michael Roizen did at Cleveland Clinic in establishing their wellness program and the savings that they generated, as well as reading a number of his books, it was just super fun. And it stretches me in a way that I typically don't get stretched doing my day job.
Fantastic. It's exciting for everyone to know. Another resource to kind of learn and listen to, you know, those experiences in the real estate space. Willie, want to thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you to all of our listeners. Remember to visit YieldTreat.com to learn more about our offerings and come to realize your next level with us. Subscribe to our YouTube channel so you never miss a show. Thank you all and see you next week.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to YieldStreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at YieldStreet.com. Thanks again for listening and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7-10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at YieldStreet.com.